Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. Our hearts are heavy today because four beautiful little girls and an outstanding school teacher were gunned down this past week by an 11-year-old boy and a 13-year-old boy. The families of these five precious people will never be the same. How can we give up our daughters and wives and not feel the loss as long as we live? But the families of these five people are not the only ones who have suffered and will suffer because of this senseless tragedy. All the children of that middle school, the teachers, the parents, and others in the Jonesboro community will live with nightmares for many years to come. Everyone in Arkansas and in the rest of the United States has been deeply hurt because of the tragedy in Jonesboro. I hope and pray that those of us who were not immediately touched by the incidents in Pearl, Mississippi, in Paducah, Kentucky, and in Jonesboro, Arkansas, will not let these tragedies pass through our minds without vowing to bring an end to such heartaches. Every one of the incidents I have mentioned has affected me because of previous connections to the cities where they occurred. When I was teaching at Freed Hardeman University, I had a number of excellent students from Pearl, Mississippi. I have never been to Pearl, but I know a number of people there. Paducah, Kentucky is not far from where my wife grew up. It is close to where I began my teaching career. The Benton High School in Benton, Kentucky, where I taught, usually played Heath High School in basketball. I know many people around Benton, Mayfield, Paducah, and Murray. Our radio programs are broadcast from Paducah, Benton, and Murray. I have never preached in Jonesboro, but I have traveled through that part of the country quite often. In addition, I have many former students and classmates who live in Jonesboro. All of the killings in these locations have caused me to grieve for our country as well as for the families who lost loved ones. I have read every article on the Jonesboro tragedy which was published by the Tennessean. I have also watched many hours of programming on CNN and on Fox News. Generally speaking, both CNN and Fox seem to have handled the Jonesboro situation quite well. The reporters on the scene in Jonesboro were not trying to read into the events more than they had a right to. They apparently were not exaggerating what they saw and heard. They were very cautious in their comments. They were not able to make sense of it all, and seem not to try to do so. I appreciate their restraint. That is not typical of the news media. There is one area of interest to all involved which I would like to examine briefly, and that is the relationship of gun ownership to such violence. Many in the media and in academia are looking for quick fixes. They do not want to admit that the media have adversely affected virtually every facet of American life. So they want to blame violence on guns and on gun owners. One woman who lost her daughter in a shooting incident said on television today, "A .357 Magnum killed my daughter." That, my friends, is simply not true. A person using a .357 Magnum killed her daughter. Guns do not kill people. People kill people with guns, automobiles, bombs, knives, sticks, fists, and in countless other ways. If it were possible, and it is not, to remove all guns from the face of the earth, killing would continue. The two boys in Jonesboro could have done far more damage with an automobile or with a homemade bomb or with fire. When people are determined to kill each other, they are going to do it regardless. Like the majority of you in my audience today, I grew up with guns. My father was what hunters and gun owners like to call a gun nut. From my earliest remembrance, my father owned not one gun, but several: shotguns, handguns, rifles, both 22s and high-powered. As he grew older, He loved to make and use muzzle-loading rifles, especially flintlocks. He reloaded his own ammunition, except for shotgun shells, and made his own muzzle-loaders. He also made muzzle-loaders for all his sons, sons-in-law, and grandsons. During the Depression, he made a living for his family by hunting. He continued hunting until he was in his 80s. When he was 81 years old, his doctor informed him that he needed surgery. Dad asked the doctor if the surgery were urgent. The doctor said no, and then asked why he did not want the surgery immediately. Dad told the doctor that deer season would be opening soon, and he wanted to go deer hunting. That season, he killed two deer, one with his flintlock and the other with his .244 Remington, both of which he had bought from my sporting goods store in Dalton, Georgia. There were eight of us Claiborne boys, one of whom died in infancy. The rest of us were taught to shoot, to hunt, and to be exceedingly careful with firearms. We were not permitted to even touch Dad's guns if he were not around. If we did, and he found out about it, there was real trouble. Trouble I would prefer not to discuss today. When my dad died in 1982, he had 11 guns and a pickup load of reloading material, most of which I had sold him. He was also a lifelong member of the National Rifle Association. Reloading, shooting, trading guns, hunting, and making muzzleloaders were my father's recreational activities. He never misused a gun and would not permit his sons to do so. Passing more restrictive gun laws and trying to take guns away from the American people will not work. It makes absolutely no sense to attempt to do so. When the United States Congress passed the 1968 gun control law, the only good which followed was getting rid of some of the senators and congressmen who voted for it. There are many more guns in our country than was true in 1968. Besides, if criminals can smuggle millions of pounds of marijuana, cocaine, and other dangerous drugs into this nation, they surely will have little trouble smuggling in guns, including assault weapons. Criminals are morally irresponsible and evil, but they are not stupid. In addition, there are thousands of gunsmiths in this country who can make rifles, handguns, and other weapons. I have no doubt that many of these gunsmiths are for hire to anyone who has enough money. Judge Robert H. Bork's latest book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah, Modern Liberalism and American Decline, argues that many have been offering the American public false panaceas, such as midnight basketball and gun control, to America's crime problems. He quotes law professor Daniel Paulsby as saying that the conventional wisdom about guns and violence is mistaken. Guns don't increase national rates of crime and violence, but the continued proliferation of gun control laws almost certainly does. Page 166. Judge Bork affirms, and most of us will readily agree, that criminals will never have any difficulty getting guns. Gun control shifts the equation in favor of the criminal. Page 167. Incidentally, Robert Bork's book should be read by every American who is concerned about the decline in moral values which our nation is experiencing. Anyone who has done any research on the topic of guns and violence knows that guns cannot be blamed for the deaths of those five people in Jonesboro. Then we must ask the question, who or what is responsible for what occurred? How I honestly wish I could provide all the answers we would like to have on this matter. But I cannot, and am not proposing that I can. I do want to raise some questions which may help us to think more soberly about this inexcusable tragedy. What part did the churches of Jonesboro play in helping the boys who did the shooting to develop good moral values? Or did they do very much? I really do not know, and I am not attempting to point an accusing finger at any of the churches or at any of the preachers. I do know some preachers in the Jonesboro area, but I do not know if they are promoting biblical moral values. Occasionally, preachers from some religious groups, including some churches of Christ, make compromises with the world and tolerate almost any kind of evil. I am sure none of the preachers in Arkansas approved of the killing of those five people. But have they preached in such a way as to curtail such abominable behavior? Have the churches in Jonesboro provided the kind of role models which young people so desperately need? Have the members of those churches made a special effort to make sure the young people were given the right kind of instruction and wholesome recreation? As all of us know, peer pressure is a vital part of growing up. Have the churches done all they could to relieve some of that peer pressure? I have no way of answering these questions, and apparently no one else does. But maybe these questions will challenge all churches and church leaders to plan better and to work harder for our children. I have no other motive in raising these questions. Most of us know that the key to cutting down on crime and delinquency is the home. Tragically, our governments, both state and federal, have in some cases made the moral situation worse. But even if governmental leaders do their best and improve the situation as much as they are able, that is not the solution to the crime problem. Governments, even the best governments, are limited in what they can do. They are not designed to be substitute parents for children. And that, dear friends, includes our government-operated public schools. The government must work at not being a part of the problem. But it is not and cannot provide the solution to our moral and spiritual conditions. Churches can and should do much teaching, encouraging and supporting the efforts of parents. If the churches want to be a part of the solution, they must preach the whole counsel of God. They cannot be excused for using valuable worship time for entertainment and for dealing with trivial matters. The attempt of many churches to fall in with the fleeting fashions of this world has left many of our young people, and older ones as well, frustrated, rudderless, and confused. In too many cases, preachers are using their time to discuss that which is politically correct, not what their listeners need, the Word of Almighty God. In some Sunday schools and in some vacation Bible schools, the time of students is wasted on non-important ideas. God will surely hold us accountable for not teaching and preaching the whole counsel of God. So far as I have been able to discern from the print media and from television, the families of the two boys in Jonesboro were quite normal, except maybe they were more aggressive in teaching their boys about guns than other families. There is much even on this subject we may never know, but somewhere there was a breakdown in communication between parents and children about the proper use of firearms. I certainly am not going to lay all the blame on the parents of these boys until we have much more information about those parents. But there are some questions which demand our attention. Did the parents of these two boys teach them the value of human life? In talking to them about using guns to protect one's person and one's home, did the parents distinguish between using guns for immoral purposes and using them only for the right reasons? After all, there are some elements of our society which are promoting hate and violence against our government and against others with whom we disagree. Have these two boys heard any of the Arkansas militias speak angrily about shooting the enemies of our government? I'm not inferring that this was the case in Jonesboro. I have heard no reporter or law enforcement officer mention the militias, but I know they exist in Arkansas and in other places throughout the United States, including right here in Tennessee. We know what happened in Oklahoma City and in Ruby Ridge, Idaho. The radical elements in our society would not hesitate to kill anyone who crossed their paths. Could these two boys in Jonesboro have heard this kind of talk from their parents, from their grandparents, and from others. If they heard the kind of ranting and raving the militia radicals promote in their publications and on the Internet, they might have thought they were morally justified in shooting those who had hurt their feelings or slighted them in some way. We will likely never know, but we do know how extremely dangerous the militias are. Were these boys in Jonesboro exposed to the senseless violence of many video games? Again, the news reporters and the police officers have not said anything about it if that were the case. If they did watch these violent video games, would that explain to some extent their killing five innocent people? Michael Medved, whom you have probably seen on public television, has spoken out very strongly against the violence in the movies and on television. His 1992 book, Hollywood vs. America, Popular Culture and the War on Traditional Values, makes the following observations. A wealth of scientific studies in recent years has removed most of the remaining doubt about the link between make-believe brutality and the real world of aggression. Medved quotes these words from Daniel Lenz, professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The consensus among social scientists is that very definitely there's a causal connection between exposure to violence in the media and violent behavior. Page 183. I agree with Michael Medved and with Dr. Daniel Lenz, except in one point Dr. Lenz made. There is no consensus among social scientists on practically any idea. According to Michael Medved, two psychologists at the University of Illinois studied more than 400 children over the course of more than 20 years. Dr. L. Rowell Huseman and Dr. Leonard Aaron found that kids who watched significant amounts of TV violence at age 8 were consistently more likely to commit violent crimes or to engage in child or spouse abuse at age 30. These psychologists wrote, "We believe that heavy exposure to televised violence is one of the causes of aggressive behavior, crime, and violence in society. Television violence affects youngsters of all ages, of both genders, at all socioeconomic levels, and all levels of intelligence. It cannot be denied or explained away." Page 184. If you want to know just how vicious and ugly many of the crimes displayed on video games and on television are, take the time to examine these forms of entertainment very closely. At almost any hour of the day or night, some of the most cruel films are shown on television or are advertised. Even the police stories, such as the Texas Ranger series, are brutal and gory. The actors on that program do more shooting of criminals in one segment than a normal policeman will do in his entire lifetime on almost any force in America. In my judgment, many of the police stories add to rather than take away from the violence which so sorely disturbs all of us. Are some of these programs popular because of the violence they portray? While I do not know if the boys in Jonesboro were exposed to extreme violence of video games or of much of television, I am confident of this. If we do not make some effort to prevent our young people's absorption in violent video games and in brutal television programs, what occurred in Jonesboro will occur elsewhere and with increasing frequency. Impressionable young minds cannot be consistently filled with violence and not be influenced by it. That was King Solomon's reason for writing, "Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life." Proverbs 4:23. The Apostle Paul admonished the Philippians, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things." Philippians 4:8. Why was Paul urging the Philippians to think about these great principles of righteousness. He knew they could not inculcate these ideas into their own lives if they did not think about them. But what if they think about their opposites? Falsehood, dishonesty, injustice, and so on. Would they likely incorporate these distasteful and destructive concepts into their conduct? You know what the answer is without my having to tell you. What kind of movies have these two little boys in Arkansas seen? Have they seen Die Hard 2 or Rambo 3 with body counts of 264 and 106 killings? Were these little boys attempting to be Arkansas Rambos? Rob Bottin, who designed the bloody special effects of Total Recall and both RoboCop movies, told Entertainment Weekly, "Anything I make has to be something moviegoers haven't seen before. That means new tricks, which means more money, which means the audience is getting their $7 worth. That's the thinking behind bigger and bigger and bigger. The question we always ask is, how do we top ourselves?" Did you notice anything in that excerpt from Medved's book which shows any concern for the influence such movies have on our nation's young people? Do such producers and directors in Hollywood have any responsibility for what happened in Pearl, Mississippi, in Paducah, Kentucky, and in Jonesboro, Arkansas? Incidentally, these killings are just the latest and most widely publicized, but killings in schools across America occur almost every day. But one teacher or one student is hardly worth noticing outside the local communities. Tragically, many of the so-called PG-rated films include an enormous amount of violence and other kinds of destructive behavior. For example, Michael Medved says that PG-rated Dick Tracy, with its 14 slayings, is aimed unmistakably at an audience of children and teenagers. Medved quotes one writer for the New York Times as saying, "If you have the impression that movies today are bloodier and more brutal than ever in the past, and that their body counts are skyrocketing, you are absolutely right. Inflation has hit the action-adventure movie with all its big slime splat." Page 187. In PG and G-rated family films, 62% featured violent fight scenes and 39% showed graphic deaths. Some of the modern mayhem films attempt to show blood and death as being funny. Arnold Schwarzenegger has made maximum effort to turn his vicious and cruel films into comedy. In Predator, which came out in 1987, the hero impales an extra against a tree with a machete, then urges the bleeding victim to stick around. In a defining moment in Total Recall, made in 1990, he makes use of an ascending elevator to separate the villainous Michael Ironside from both of his forearms. As he is left holding the bloody stumps that are all that remains of his opponent, he quips, "See you at the party." According to Medved, a 12-year-old girl named Betsy, interviewed after a matinee of Total Recall, told a reporter for Entertainment Weekly, "I can't say that it's violent, really. It's pretty funny to see people getting shot in the head." Page 189. I wonder if it's pretty funny for the parents, for the school teachers, and for the other students at Jonesboro to know of their fellow students being killed by two little boys. I'm not saying that these boys had watched Total Recall or Predator or Rambo 3 or any other morally offensive material. But I have no doubt that such movies desensitize children and adults to the horror of killing and other forms of violence. How could it do otherwise? I wonder why the gun control advocates are not concerned about what our children see on television, in the movies, and participate in at video arcades. They might have an impact on the nation for good if they were as devoted to eliminating violence in public entertainment as they are about removing guns from the hands of responsible gun owners. But they are not going to do that. After all, everyone has a right to his own private opinion and to his own private behavior, except gun owners. The liberals picture gun owners as the very scum of the earth. I shall close today with a brief reference to an article from the Tennessean, March the 26th, 1998. The article has the title, "Self-Love and Worth Will End Kids' Violence." The author of the article does not blame the tragedy at Jonesboro on the violent television programs which children watch, on the brutal video games many of them play, or on the movies, such as Total Recall and Rambo 3. The author of the letter to the editor writes, "These are problems, that is, violence in our schools, drugs, sex, and disrespect. But I could only come to one conclusion. These are not the problems. These are symptoms of a much greater problem. The problem is poor self-esteem." Page 16a. What an absolutely inexcusable explanation for the tragedy at Jonesboro. If anything, these boys may have had too much self-esteem. They were apparently not concerned about anyone else's welfare. They did what they wanted to do. The boys' problem was not poor self-esteem, but poor regard for the welfare of others. Some of the worst criminals on record almost certainly had high self-esteem, but they were seriously lacking in decency and in honor and in the milk of human kindness. My friends, will you continue to pray for all who have been so deeply hurt by the tragedy at Jonesboro? Thank you for listening today, and may our Father in heaven bless you.